Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a critical, cultural, and timeless education that puts life into perspective. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you've ever debated what resources should be devoted to space exploration, consider this question. How much do we really know about our own planet? Although more than 70% of the surface of the Earth is covered by water, only about 10% of that terrain has been mapped in detail. But as scientists gain knowledge about how the condition of the oceans relates to the health of the planet as a whole, they are also pioneering new ways to understand the mysterious and largely unexplored world beneath the water. My guest today is at the forefront of that field. Dr. Dawn Wright, called Deep Sea Dawn by students and colleagues, is professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. She specializes in software that adapts geographic information systems for use in the three-dimensional space of the world's oceans. She's in town to address the 2008 Geotech Conference at Bishop Dunn High School this weekend, and we are delighted that she could be with us this afternoon. Dawn, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a great honor to be here.
So let's talk about mapping the oceans. People hear that and they think, well, we know where the coastlines are. Talk about what else there is that we need to understand.
Well, when you look at a normal map of the world or a globe of the world, the oceans are colored in blue. And that's so unsatisfactory in a way because there's a whole complex terrain that's underneath that blue. That's the portion that we don't know very much about. And the reason why we don't know very much about it is because it's all covered by water. We're able to have these wonderful satellite images of the entire world, such as the images of the Earth from space, because most of the sensors can see very well through the atmosphere, but they cannot see through the water. So we have to use ships at sea and use sound waves instead of electromagnetic energy in order to see through the water down to the ocean floors, and also to understand all of the things that are happening in the water column or in the water itself. And so that takes time and effort. And as such, that's why we only have about 10% of the ocean floor mapped at the same level of detail as, for instance, a hiking map to a national park or maps of our cities, cityscapes, landscapes. So in order to have that similar level of detail, we have to use the sound energy as emitted from research ships.
So when you talk about different terrains, you mean mountains and valleys, and you've studied
yes.
fissures that are deep under the surface?
Yes. So we're talking about mapping mountain ranges, underwater mountain ranges. There are mountains on the ocean floor that are higher than the Himalayas. And there are trenches on the ocean floor that you could fit Mount Everest down into. And there are all kinds of large cracks and faults. There are individual small mountains that we call seamounts. There are vast plains. So all of the different kinds of terrain that we're familiar with on land, we have the equivalent of that, usually in greater size and scope on the ocean floor.
Was any of that terra firma at some point before the Earth started to change and when Pangaea broke up?
Oh, some of that was above the surface of the water, but most of it has always been submerged. Mm-hmm. And so this really is the other part of our planet that we're trying to discover. So a lot of people think that we are no longer in an age of discovery, but that couldn't be further from the truth because there's still so much that we need to find out about the planet, and we do not have it mapped at the same scope as we have, for instance, Mars and Venus mapped.
So we know more about those other planets than what's on our own.
We do. And in terms of the topography or the surface of the entire planet, we know more about those planets.
So you talked about sonar and sending sound waves down and you know, I guess they bump off things and you can sort of make out the shape. You've also gone into a submersible. Is it an Alvin unit? Is that what they're called?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk about what that experience is like, how you get ready for it, and then what it's like to go down under the surface?
It's a real thrill. I think for a lot of us, it's our only chance to pretend that we are an astronaut because there's talk of outer space. When you go into the oceans, that's inner space. That's on our own planet, of course, but it's a weightless environment for the submersible. And when you're in a submersible, it's like being in a space capsule, and you descend into this unknown, dark abyss, and it's very, very exciting. It's a lot easier than going into space because we don't have to wear spacesuits. The personnel sphere or the capsule within a capsule that you're sitting in as a scientist, everything is climate controlled, temperature controlled. We usually can do a submersible dive wearing sweatpants and a long sleeve T-shirt. And it's a little cramped. But other than that, it's very comfortable and you can take your lunch down there. They usually play music as you're exploring.
How much ground can you cover in a single dive?
Well, that depends on what your dive is supposed to accomplish. Sometimes a dive is just supposed to photograph or survey an area, but other dives have the mission to actually take a sample back up to the surface. So we're looking for rock samples, or if we come across a hydrothermal vent, which is like a hot spring under the ocean where there's superheated water that's coming up through cracks or through these chimneys, then you want to take a sample of that in order to measure the chemistry. Or there are all of these creatures that live in complete darkness on the ocean floor, and you might want to take a sample of those. So depending on what you want to sample, that can extend the length of your dive. But on the dives that I've been a part of, we were down on the ocean floor for anywhere from 4 to 6 hours. And then it takes about 2 hours to get down to that particular depth and 2 hours to get back up. So it's a full day's work.
Do you have to deal with claustrophobia at all?
Yes. I think some people struggle with that a little bit. They do ask you if you struggle with epilepsy or if you have trouble with claustrophobia. And I've never known anyone who has struggled with that to the extent that they were not allowed to go on a dive. But they do ask that of everybody.
So you talked about bringing your lunch and your uncomfortable clothes. What sorts of tools do you have with you? Is it just you and a computer? Do you take a sketchbook? What do you need with you?
It's interesting because I think the most important tool on a lot of these dives is the tape recorder, because we don't really use a lot of complex equipment ourselves, because the submersible itself is the instrument that we're using. The submersible has robotic arms that can reach out and grab things, and that's controlled by the pilot. Usually with U.S. submersibles, there is a pilot and then two scientific observers. And we have the pilot do the sampling, grabbing a rock on the ocean floor or sticking a probe into a vent to take a temperature or extracting fluids from a vent in order to take that back to the surface. But for the scientific observer, we are looking out the porthole and we are describing everything that we're seeing. And we do that into a microphone, into a tape recorder, and then that is transcribed or written out when we get back. So on the dives that I participated in, that's been the most important scientific instrument.
So it's exceptionally dark at the surface of the ocean, right?
Yes. On the ocean floor, it's completely dark.
Do the animals that are used to that environment, do they scatter when you apply a light, or do they just not even sense it because they don't have the facility to see light?
Well, from what I've seen of the deep sea crabs and shrimp, and also these long fish called ratfish, they didn't react to the light at all. Now, I'm not a biologist, so I'm not an expert in all of the deep sea species, because my main task has been to look at the rocks and the structure of the ocean floor. But it has been very interesting to see how these creatures react, and they don't, the ones that I've seen. Some of them don't have eyes, or their eyes are very undeveloped. And so for them, they're just living in this other, it's sort of like another dimension, because down there, I've been down to a depth of about 2,500 meters, which is about a mile and a half. And at that depth, the pressure is crushing. It's 2 tons per square inch down there. No light at all. So they're in complete darkness. So they are living in another way. It's like they're in another dimension. And so some things just didn't bother them. They didn't mind our presence.
So you talked about vents and cracks and hot springs. People have described this as a sort of a plumbing system within the ocean. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it really is a wonderfully complex system as far as the scientific community knows about it at this point, because, again, there's so much more that we need to be able to observe and to derive from the instrumentation that we leave on the ocean floor there. But we can also do experiments where we can leave a sensor on the ocean floor and have it gather data over a series of time, and then we can look at the results from that.
But like a space probe would be sent.
Yes,
out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And these are, in fact, this is another exciting aspect of oceanographic research right now, because there are these places that are being established as long-term observatories where we are leaving, for instance, seismic instruments that are sensing earthquakes. And earthquakes are a very important part of this picture, because oftentimes with an earthquake there is a cracking on the ocean floor, especially at these places where new material from the earth is being created and being added to the ocean floor. So you have cracks that are part of that process. The cracks allow the cold water to go into the interior of the earth. That water is superheated and travels through a whole series of underwater or subterranean cracks, a network of cracks, moves through those cracks, and then somehow makes its way to the surface again, to the surface of the ocean floor, through another series of cracks. And by the time that water comes out there, it's superheated since it's been inside of the earth. And that superheated water is laden with minerals that it's picked up along its journey. And as that water comes out onto the ocean floor, then it can build these chimney structures. And when that superheated water hits the very, very cold water that's above the ocean floor, then those minerals drop out and form the actual chimney structure. And then you have that building on top of each other. And then you have the chimneys that hopefully a lot of people have seen now on National Geographic or the Discovery Channel. And those chimneys become the site for these ecosystems. So we have the bacteria that form there and the animals that congregate there. And so when human beings come upon that, they are coming into some of these places. It's like a vast city, underwater city, where we have this whole ecosystem functioning.
So they look somewhat like stalagmites under
good way to describe them.
And how fragile are they?
Some of them are very fragile. In scientific terms, we call them very friable or crumbly. Mm-hmm. Some of them are have some of the volcanic rock associated with them as well, so they're a little harder. But that's one thing that we're still trying to find out, the entire life cycle of these kinds of structures and how long they do last on the ocean floor. In some areas where there's a lot of earthquake activity, a lot of cracking, a lot of seafloor spreading, such as in the eastern Pacific where I've had the opportunity to go, these places may be built up and then torn down over just a matter of years. So we're still trying to understand the time scales as to how long these things are on the ocean floor, how are they rebuilt, how are the ecosystems reformed, and so forth.
Is there more seismic activity per square mile of surface in the ocean than there is on land?
I would say yes, because when you look at a map of the Earth's major plate boundaries, for those who are familiar with plate tectonics, most of those major boundaries where the Earth is either cracked and coming apart, or where one piece of the Earth is going underneath another piece. Most of those boundaries are in our world's oceans.
My guest is Deep Sea Dawn, Dr. Dawn Wright. She's professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. We'll return to our conversation after this break, and you can get on the line to ask a question at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Dawn is in town to address the 2008 Geotech Conference at Bishop Dunn High School in Dallas. You can find information about that on the Think page of kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a critical, cultural, and timeless education that puts life into perspective. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Deep Sea Dawn, Dr. Dawn Wright, who's professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. She's a speaker at the 2008 Geotech Conference this weekend at Bishop Dunn High School. You can join our conversation today by sending email to think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Mark in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Thanks, Dr. Dawn, for taking my call. I've been following your career for a long, long time, and it's a real pleasure to be able to finally talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
I have two daughters, and I'm wondering what led you to your career in oceanography, and what would you suggest as far as a way of guiding my two children into the sciences, and especially the marine sciences?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you. Well, for me, I grew up in the Hawaiian Islands, so I was already surrounded by the oceans, and that combined with watching Jacques Cousteau on TV pretty much did the trick for me. I decided when I was around 8 years old that I wanted to be involved in ocean science. And from there, it was just a matter of trying to get my hands on as many books as I could and trying to find out how do you go about becoming an ocean scientist. Now it is so easy because there's so much wonderful material that's on the web, and there are also specific programs that are in place now for young people to learn about careers in oceanography or other aspects of oceanography. You don't have to become an ocean scientist, but there's so much important work that needs to be done now in the area of ocean policy and ocean management. There are a lot of programs in our National Marine Sanctuary system. So, for instance, in Texas, there's a National Marine Sanctuary that's called the Flower Garden Banks for the Gulf of Mexico. So these are great places to visit because these are the equivalent of our national parks. So these are great places to take your daughters. There is all of this wonderful material that's on the web. If you go to, for instance, the Ocean Explorers Program, this is a series of expeditions that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration sponsors. And all of these explorations are scientific in nature, but they have really strong educational components to them. So you can go to any of the websites of these expeditions, and there is just a wonderful treasure trove of material that teachers can use in the classroom, or anybody who is curious about the oceanography being done there can explore on their own. So I would encourage you to check out these resources on the web for your daughters. Surf to these different sites with them. There may be some programs at your daughter's schools that talk about ocean science. And it's just a matter of what they're interested in and supporting them in that. And it's a much broader open field now for women in marine science, I would say, and for people of color. So it's really a great time to be getting involved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, or you can send email today to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Kent in Hearst. Hi, Kent.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a question. I was going to ask you what you thought geology, what effect geology had on political boundaries and or the stability of governments around the world.
Oh, that's a great question. In terms of the oceans, I'm not sure there has been as close a connection between geology and political boundaries, because there you're talking about the ocean floor. And again, we still don't know very much about the ocean floor, so I don't think that has had as big of an impact on creating marine boundaries. And by marine boundaries, I'm talking about, for instance, we have an exclusive economic zone, which is the United States boundary that's 200 miles offshore of our shoreline. Now, in terms of states, state boundaries, geology can have quite an impact there when you're looking at the shoreline, or, for instance, promontories or spits or peninsulas that are made of sand and are subject to erosion, and therefore they can disappear at certain times or they can reappear. So that may have an impact in terms of the boundaries associate it with states or counties, for instance, along the Gulf Coast here. I think for anybody who's looking at marine policy, because the area of maritime boundaries, shipping, resource management, it is important to know about all aspects of the coastal and ocean domain. So a lot of people who are getting trained in these areas now, they do take geology courses, even though that's not going to be their primary field of expertise. So I hope that gets to the crux of what you were seeking for an answer.
Have you ever had problems getting permission to do research in a particular area that was perhaps the domain of a particular country? Do you have to apply for permission?
Yes, in many areas you do. For instance, I've been doing research in American Samoa, which is a U.S. territory. So it's been fairly easy to get permission to work in those waters because I'm from, of course, an American institution. But when you're trying to work, for instance, in a national marine sanctuary or a national park, and you need to have the permission to do research in those waters because sometimes the parks are designated for purposes that are mainly to make sure that the area can recover. So some mm-hmm. places are no take or no activity there. Other places allow you to do research. And in American Samoa, it's very interesting because all of the land there is the United States leases that land from the local communities because that is under the jurisdiction of the tribes, the village communities in American Samoa. And for instance, the national park that is there is leased to the American government by the people and the government of Samoa. So you have to seek permission to work in those areas.
And that's one region where you've actually been able to observe some of the reefs coming back and all that since
yes.
protection efforts have started?
Yes, American Samoa has a very nice story in terms of many of those reefs being almost completely destroyed by a number of different causes, by hurricanes, by the invasion of the crown of thorns starfish. And we're not quite sure, or at least the marine biology community is not quite sure, I don't think, what causes these mass invasions of crown of thorns. They're sort of like the oceanographic equivalent of locusts, and they descend upon these reefs and destroy them. So hurricanes and crown of thorns have been a problem. There's also been human pressures, such as illegal dynamite fishing in the area.
Dynamite and fishing, they put explosive down into the water.
And set them off and then collect the fish. So that's, of course, very damaging to reefs. There have been problems with sewage outfalls and just general pollution in the area. So all of this has, of course, been terrible for coral reefs. And this is a problem that we're facing throughout the reefs of the world, where the coral reefs are like the tropical rainforests. And we don't know what we're losing in terms of species and biodiversity there, that whether there may be a cure for cancer in some of these reefs. Anyway, in American Samoa, they've taken measures to protect many of these reefs, including the Whangateli Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And the Whangateli Bay National Marine Sanctuary over the last 20 years or so has now been given a pretty clean bill of health because that area has been set aside so that it can recover completely. And it's making great progress. The harbor there in American Samoa was also one of the most polluted harbors in that region because of tuna canneries that for many years dumped their effluent directly into the harbor. So the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has been involved in helping that area to get a cleaner bill of health. So I think American Samoa is an example of a place where you can take action and you can turn things around.
It's great to hear it finally on the right side.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Professor of Geography and Oceanography, Dr. Dawn Wright. Her students call her Deep Sea Dawn. She is from Oregon State University. She's in town to speak to the 2008 Geotech Conference over at Bishop Dunn High School. Let's go next to Alice in Dallas. Hi, Alice.
Hi. Dr. Dunn, are you African American?
Yes, I'm African American.
Well, you certainly sound African American, and I'm just impressed listening to your conversation today. You have really explained all about oceanography in such layman terms that makes it so interesting. I'm just driving along in my car, and I start listening to you, and you've got me hooked, line and sinker, literally.
Oh, well, so, thank you very much.
Keep up the good work. It's just, you make it so interesting. It's layman terms, because a lot of times when you're listening to programs like this, the terminology that's used is so far over your head that you don't understand, but you have a knack to just lay it out and make it interesting and make it understandable. So thank you, and please keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you very much, Alice. I really appreciate that. I listened to Talk of the Nation Science Friday and to listen to how the scientists do it there. It's a good role model.
We should talk about this a little bit, because I know that you have said science comes natural to you, always has, but the teaching part was something you really had to work on. And it's something you feel like is as important a component of your career as any of the research you do.
Yes. For me, teaching is a labor of love. It takes a lot of hard effort, because it is very difficult to explain things in a way that can really ignite the imagination of a student or keep them engaged. And the saying goes, you don't really understand how much you know a subject until you teach it. So it's also a challenge for those of us who are scientists as well, because it's one thing to be in our own niche and to be cloistered in our lab and working with our numbers and our pictures and our jargon, the ivory tower language that we use with each other. But oftentimes I find that I understand more about my own subject area if I can translate it into terms that an undergraduate or a high school student can understand, or if I can explain it to my mother and then she understands it. And then also for policymakers, one of the things that we're trying to convince many of our coastal governments is the need for even more mapping, because if we don't have that very critical data set, then we are going to be literally putting ourselves at risk. So it takes being able to translate our science into terms that our governors and our legislatures can understand. And the example for Oregon is very powerful, because we live on a very active plate tectonic boundary, and we are very much at risk of a major tsunami explaining that we could have a major earthquake. There's talk about California with the big earthquakes that they can get. We could get a very major magnitude 9 earthquake within the next 50 years, not that far off the Oregon coast, which would then generate a tsunami that would be headed straight for the Oregon and Washington coast. A scientific colleague of mine has said that if we have such a tsunami, that would make Katrina look like a breezy day.
Wow.
Because the destruction, our plate boundary is very similar to what's in Sumatra, and therefore we could have a Sumatra-like earthquake and tsunami. To make a long story short, in order to understand how the tsunami wave would act, how much of and how what would be the extent of the inundation along the Oregon coast when that tsunami feels the bottom and hits us, we must have the bathymetry, or in other words, we must have the ocean floor mapped in great detail right within our territorial sea. So that's from our shoreline out to about 3 miles out. And that's another area where we only have about 5 to 10% of our territorial sea mapped, and this is in Oregon. All of our states are struggling with this. I don't know what the Texas territorial sea coverage is like. California
got a lot of space to cover.
And there's a lot of space to cover. California is trying to map their areas. Anyway, we have been trying to talk to our state government about the importance of this. And in Oregon, our territorial sea is owned by our governor, our secretary of state, and our treasurer, which is called our state land board. So it's their territory. They have to manage it. They own it. So we're trying to get them to understand how important it is to fund a mapping of that effort. So to circle back a long way from when I first started on this, being able to translate the principles of mapping and the importance of mapping to these policymakers is really critical.
Dr. Deep Sea Dawn Wright is my guest. She's professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. We have, I believe, a related question from Charlie in Lakewood. Hey, Charlie.
Hi. Don, How are these tsunami detectors constructed? What is their nature? How are they laid out in the ocean? And how do they communicate with bases? And in best case scenario, what how long of an advanced notice could potential victims be given as to when a tsunami wave is approaching and will hit?
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, and it really depends on where the original earthquake is that will generate the tsunami, how far offshore that particular earthquake event is. So I'll just use Oregon as an example. Our zone of earthquake activity is several miles off the coast, which is not a very good scenario for us because then we only have about 15 to 45 minutes warning when that tsunami wave is generated. And I think throughout the Pacific and now the Indian Ocean, the advanced warning system consists of buoys, and these buoys are out on the ocean surface, bobbing around on the water. And with a tsunami, when you have the earthquake generated, there's a shifting of the ocean floor. That shifting of the ocean floor disrupts the water, so it disrupts the ocean. It sets a wave in motion. It's a very long wavelength wave, so it's very long horizontally, but it's very small and short vertically. But these buoys can detect that wave. And when they detect that wave, they send a signal to a satellite. The satellite sends a signal back to a warning center, and then the warning center sends out the information from there.
And that's all assuming that it works perfectly.
Yes, yeah. That's in the best case scenario.
Dr. Dawn Wright is my guest. She's in town to speak to the 2008 Geotech Conference at Bishop Dunn High School. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org or at BDHS.org. We'll return to our conversation and your questions in just a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Dawn Wright, Deep Sea Dawn. She's professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University, in town for the 2008 Geotech Conference at Bishop Dunn High School. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Dawn, can you explain why it's been so hard to amalgamate all the different bits of information that scientists have been collecting from all over the world for decades?
Yes, that has been a very significant problem, mainly because the information has been in different formats. In the oceans, we can measure everything from the sea surface height, looking at the waves, to the different kinds of fish. Trying to map or track a school of fish is very difficult. And then we have the different phenomena on the ocean floor, such as earthquake activity or trying to understand the locations and the distributions of these hydrothermal vents or of faults on the ocean floor. All of those data sets that I've, or pieces of information that I've talked about, are collected with different kinds of instruments. So it would be like almost like the different kinds of parts of a car. They're assembled in different assembly lines, and they may be made by different manufacturers, and it's up to the car maker to take all those different parts and piece them together on a main assembly line so that you have your car.
But if you can put them together, a marine biologist might say, wow, in that same place that the superheated water is 100 meters below, you have a different kind of marine life.
Exactly. So this is where the mapping and database management systems that we use in oceanography now are so important, because they can take different kinds of data. They can compile them. They can integrate them. and we can make maps of them so that we can look at the biologist's data along with the different kinds of seafloor features that a geologist might look at. We can also add in the chemical data, maybe the different concentrations of chemicals that are in the water that are important to the biology or that are being produced by the geology. All of these things are combined in these database and mapping systems. And so then you can have a biologist sit down with a chemist or with a geologist, and they can see how their data set is looking as compared to the other data sets and get the broader picture.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Leslie in Dallas. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I have a question regarding, the Gulf of Mexico. What would you think is the single largest surprising geographic thing of interest about the Gulf?
Now, the Gulf of Mexico is unfortunately not in my expertise because I do my studies in the Western Pacific. But from what I understand of my colleagues who work in the Gulf of Mexico, there are major banks and reefs that are still being mapped and discovered there in the Gulf. And once you find the actual physical discovery, for instance, if you discover a new embankment or a new underwater mountain, then you can go back to that area with other kinds of instruments or observations to see what kinds of species live there, to see what the chemistry of the water is like. I know in the Gulf of Mexico there are these what are called cold seeps that have been a surprise to many scientists, because when we think about water coming out of the ocean floor and forming these vents, the main picture that we've had in our mind is, and in our observations, has been the superheated water. Well, there are areas in the Gulf of Mexico where the water is not superheated, and as such, they're called cold seeps, but there's still some very bizarre and interesting marine life that are congregated around these seeps.
Are those does that have anything to do with when you're standing in the ocean and suddenly the water around you is much colder than it was just a moment ago? Could that be related at all?
Well, you can sense or pick up these extreme differences in temperature. They would be just on the order of a couple of degrees of Celsius or Fahrenheit, but they're still very significant environment. So you can go from a warmer area to a colder area and vice versa. And so that's usually picked up with the instruments that we're placing in the area or that we are towing through an area.
Let's go next to Santa Cruz and talk to Sue. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I want to ask Dr. Wright what she enjoys most about her role as an educator. You obviously spend a lot of time educating the public, and I just wanted to find out how you enjoy that.
Well, I think what's most enjoyable for me is to see the light bulbs coming on in students or audiences. One of the classes that I teach is an introduction to oceanography class. It's called Exploring the Deep, and I have 300 students in that class. So sometimes it can be very discouraging because that's just too big of a class to be trying to teach. But in every class, there is somebody in the front row or even somebody in the middle of the class or the back of the class who I can see is really receiving everything, really excited, really trying to understand it. And that student may even come up afterwards or send me an email saying, oh, I'd never thought about this before. I never realized this before. This is so great. Thank you for introducing me to this. Or likewise, if I'm speaking to an audience, say at a public library or at a conference such as Geotech, the reaction of people in the audience, especially children, is very, very rewarding.
Are you seeing a change in how non-scientists respond to learning about science now?
Yes, and I think the internet has a lot to do with that because, again, there's so many great resources on the internet, and a lot of these internet resources are related to the wonderful programming that is on TV and radio. So you might have a radio show or a TV show, let's say something that's on the Discovery Channel, the National Geographic Channel, and you will be enraptured by this one-hour show, but then you can go to the accompanying website and you could spend hours going through the photographs and looking at actual data sets and hearing more in terms of audio and video sound bites or picture bites. And it's just an extended wealth of information that's available. And so if you're not a scientist, that is very, I think, very attractive.
Request for, it looks like a technical clarification from Durai. He says, you made going into deep waters and back sound very simple. I remember having read that a number of people in the initial days actually died while getting out of deep pressure areas, even though they were in diving bells, etc. Isn't pressure equalization not necessary anymore, or how are we getting around it?
Well, it's still very dangerous, and that's a good point, because even when we go down to the ocean floor in modern submersibles, we take for granted all of the technology and engineering that goes into that. I guess that one example from my own experience is with the Alvin submersible, which is operated by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. In that particular submersible, the personnel sphere can detach and float to the surface in case Alvin is trapped on the ocean floor, because we shouldn't forget that these submersibles are not tethered to a ship, so if something goes wrong, they cannot be pulled back to safety. So in a way, they're like the space shuttle that's going out on its own, and if something goes wrong, then you have to deal with that situation in a very unusual way, or it may not turn out to be positive. So with the Alvin submersible, if the I recall one dive where the submersible was actually wedged into a crevice and there was an overhang. I was not on that particular dive, but I was listening on the communication from the ship, the mothership. And if the pilot, Cindy Vandover was the pilot, and she had not been able to get the submersible unwedged from that crevice, they would have had a really hard time escaping, because releasing the personnel sphere with the three people inside of it would have been, thwarted by the fact that they had an overhang. They had a ledge of rock over them. Now, I've not heard of any situation where there was actually an emergency like that, but it's good to know that there are safety measures in place, and the pilots who are operating these submersibles are highly trained, and you really do put your life in their hands when you're in the ocean.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Michael in Dallas. Hey, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm enjoying this immensely. My question or inquiry has to do with the fact that I have fished extensively in the Gulf of Mexico, 80 to 100 miles out, with captains who are, you know, licensed captains, guides, etc., who keep their own charts showing reefs and areas where there would be prime fishing, but they are unwilling to share this information with others because that is where they want to. They want to protect that for their own clients. And I was wondering if there's been any effort made to coordinate or get them to cooperate, at least for the scientific benefit, for the charting of the Gulf.
An interesting question.
Yes, that's an excellent question, Michael. I'm not as familiar with what's going on here in the Gulf of Mexico, since I'm based on the West Coast, but we have a similar situation where we have a fishing community that has their own charts and their own special areas to fish. And commercial fishing is an extremely important part of our state's economy, and I'm sure that's the case here in Texas as well. And I think part of it comes down to trying to establish a system of trust between the fishing community, whether it be recreational or commercial fishing, and the scientific community, where everyone can see that each has an equal stake, for instance, in the health of the oceans. If we want to be able to protect areas that are prime fishing areas, not so that we can keep the fishermen out, but so that we can make sure that they can continue to fish there and keep their livelihood going, then it's to each other's interest to share information back and forth to make sure that can continue. So I'm not familiar with the social and cultural dynamics, because it does get down to a social and a cultural situation in addition to the science, what's going on here in Texas. But there's also the situation where the scientists can collect some very detailed data for their work. For instance, in terms of the microbathymetry, where you really have a fine scale map of the ocean floor at a very high level of detail. And if scientists collect that data, they can make that available to the fishing community so that they can benefit as well. In fact, a lot of oceanographic research is funded with U.S. taxpayer dollars. So it is incumbent upon us to make that data publicly available at some point anyway. And usually the situation is that after we've had a chance to publish the data in our scientific journals and to actually complete the research that we've been funded to do, then we make that data publicly available for a broad variety of uses with the proper documentation that goes along with it so that the data can be used appropriately.
Dawn, is there a single essential question that defines your work?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I guess one of the major questions for me is what is out there? Where are things located? What are the distributions of these features? And I'm speaking mainly of the ocean floor, because that's the first primary question before we can actually understand how to use different areas on the ocean floor. We have to know what is there. We have to be able to map it. So it really gets back to a very fundamental initial exploration of areas.
I read somewhere that you still get seasick. Is that true?
Yes, that's that's been one of the
that's a horrible irony.
It is, but it's something that thankfully I've been able to work through. I usually have to be ill the first 2 days of an oceanographic cruise. For some reason, the seasick medicines don't work for me. They make me actually worse. But I also, I guess I have that kind of sensitivity. Coffee actually makes me sleepy. So whatever's going on with my system.
You're just upside down all the way.
Yes. But it's one of those labors of love where it's been totally worth it to be uncomfortable and to go through that, because the science is so exciting, and I absolutely love going to sea. The sense of adventure is still there. It's very peaceful at sea, and it really is absolutely fantastic. So it's just one of those things.
Dr. Deep Sea Dawn Wright is a professor of geography and oceanography at Oregon State University. She's in town to address the 2008 Geotech Conference at Bishop Dunn High School. You can find information about that at bdhs.org or on the think page of kera.org. Dawn, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.